Liberation theology, for those of you who don't know, is a label that has been given to the school of thought that focuses on Bible principles, particularly in the New Testament, to be deployed to raise up the consciousness of the oppressed. Liberation theology came into being, as we know it, shortly after the Civil War in this country. Black theologians came on the scene and noticed a kinship with Jesus and his followers. Like Jesus and his disciples, they were oppressed. Like Jesus and his followers, they could bring forth a message of freedom. They worked their way out of their situation, and if not being able to get free, they could at least have tools to confront the powers of the day. Their use of the term consciousness is very similar to our own in divine science. A theologian at Union Theological Seminary has written a book. It is entitled The New Abolition. The author is Gary Dorian. He writes the following: there is a profound insight about the sociology of consciousness and power. Power plays a role in all modern and postmodern philosophies influenced by Hegelian or Marxist theory. Now, Hegel was a philosopher. Hegel had famously reasoned the following: self-consciousness exists only in being acknowledged. When self-conscious awareness encounters another self-consciousness, it comes out of itself, finding itself in the other being, and it supersedes the other in doing so. Lofty words, but you recognize the problem. In divine science, we attempt to solve that problem. Our founders write about the three levels of consciousness. The first is a superconsciousness, or the Christ mind. That's the Father expressing on the plane of the individual. We call it Christ consciousness. We're all trying to attain Christ consciousness. Then there is the consciousness level of mind with the Son expressing on the plane of the individual. Lastly, there is the subconscious level of mind, and that is the Holy Ghost manifesting on the plane of the individual. The rub comes in that second level of consciousness. The rub comes in when man's thinking, man who has the ability to create, creative action, does so from an unreliable base. If we were to operate from the basis scientifically, based upon truth, truth to the principle that God's law of good is in action, we're fine. But we often find we produce varied conditions in our life. And why is that? That's because we have allowed a relative level of consciousness to invade our thoughts. That takes away the reliable basis from which we are designed to operate. And if we do not operate from that reliable basis, from the standpoint of God's law of good, well, we're going to produce the same, the very varied conditions in our life that we are experiencing. You see, the one thinker is God. The one God mind produces ideas in man. Whether man thinks about those ideas truly or falsely really doesn't matter. Results are going to come forth according to his way of thinking and will manifest scientifically by the law of expression in his experiences, conditions, and affairs. So, when we take our self-consciousness or awareness and do not derive it from God, but derive it from the other or from external circumstances, then we have difficulty, particularly if the other is a society that is controlled or governed with a whole series of oppressive relationships. Now, we know and cannot deny that the foundations of this country were based upon oppressive relationships. In the South, it was master and servant. In the industrial Northeast, it was the employer and employee. In each category, the servant or the employee was not paid the full value of his or her wages, because that's where the owners make a profit. That is inherently oppressive, but it was even more so with respect to the system of slavery. Black theologian W.E.B. Du Bois wrote an article for the Atlantic Monthly in 1897. 1897, over 100 years ago. Now, he uses anachronistic terms. The title of it was The Strivings of the Negro People. In that article, he wrote for the Atlantic, and he said something stunning. He said, after the Egyptian and the Indian, the Greek and the Roman, the Teuton and the Mongolian, the Negro is a sort of seventh son, born with a veil, gifted with second sight in the American world, the world which yields him no self-consciousness, but only lets him define his self-consciousness through its systems, through the revelation of this other world. This is a peculiar sensation, Du Bois writes, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of the other, measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on. Whenever feels his two-ness, an American and a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, warring ideals whose dogged strength in the man alone keeps him from being torn asunder. The history of the Black man and woman, according to Du Bois in 1897, mind you, was the longing to attain a self-conscious manhood or womanhood and to merge that double self into a better and truer self. In divine science, we would say, rise in consciousness. Well, this is the foundations of Black liberation theology. His forecast was at the time of the writing that there would be an end to this striving and that there would be a collaboration within the culture that would allow everybody to escape death and isolation and to use everybody's best powers. He wrote, and this is of course after the Civil War and during the Reconstruction, that the freedman had not yet found in freedom his promised land. Whatever of lesser good may have come in these years have changed the shadow of a deep disappointment. The attained ideal was unbounded, save by the simple ignorance. Du Bois was not the only person writing about the concept of double consciousness at that time. Emerson also spoke of double consciousness. His perception is the dichotomy between a grubby, calculating, sensate lower self and the higher self of a reflective soul. For Emerson, the idea of a double consciousness had a redemptive quality to it. That redemptive quality was an internal struggle. For Du Bois, it was an outward problem. It was a problem of having to be forced to be seen through the eyes of the other. That type of duality and oppression is what leads to the foundational thought behind liberation theology, and it is right in line with our own divine science and the urge, the instigation to get away from a dual nature of thinking, get away from the dual thinking of good versus evil, because all is good. Now, this liberation theology is not limited to oppression in the Americas. If you Google liberation theology, you will come across many, many others. One in point is a Palestinian liberation theology today being propounded by a Palestinian Episcopalian priest in that war-torn region. The whole problem we are forced to confront is this. What is our work to be done to free ourselves? Not just to free ourselves from oppression. For in a society, as it would appear, going all the way back to King Ahab's time, and even before that, there's always this element of oppression built into the fundamental social dynamic. And the question becomes, what do we individually do about it? And can we, as individuals, affect it and make it better? And of course, Jesus would say we could. Let's look back at the biblical passages from our call to worship section this morning. For there we had King Ahab, metaphysically representing the state of consciousness controlled by the mind. We have King Jehoshaphat from the kingdom of Judah, metaphysically representing that state of consciousness controlled by the heart or feeling natures. Notice the interplay. Ahab and Jehoshaphat are in a struggle. How do they perceive themselves? And how does the world perceive them? And the prophets are attempting to show them, you may be kings, but you're not all that. Of course, the other prophets other than Micah are saying exactly what the kings want them to hear. Micah eventually tells King Ahab the truth. Don't try to control or regain what you think you are going to, as you will fail and be killed. That's good advice, for so often our hearts and our minds get set upon getting what we want, getting our way. And what happens? The wisdom of the world or the way of the world, if we ignore it, well, we put ourselves in an even more precarious position. That is why the so-called prosperity Bible folks who say if you put your mind and your heart on it, you can get what you want. And that is true. Problem is, what you get and what you want may not be what you needed to obtain. And why do we do all of this? We do it because we are operating from a self-consciousness that is not hewed to God's law. We insist upon forming our self-consciousness in relation to relative things, which are, how does society view us? Or worse still, how do we think society is perceiving us? Our attempts to influence that, rather than staying true to ourselves, brings us to a battlefield and leaves us alone. We think we're disguised, but we end up with an errant arrow in us anyway. Our mind thinks it can trick everybody into thinking that we are who we are not. And then, of course, that isn't the case. Our mind is a massive, massive trickster. And if we let it trick us, we will soon have a self-consciousness that is not set aright on the right path. And we're instead looking for things, places, circumstances through which we can define ourselves, rather than our true nature. Our true nature is that we are of God, children of God, individualized expressions of God. And that is the point of liberation theology, and it shares a common ground with our teaching in terms of its use of the idea of self-consciousness. Let us look at the Bible, look at the religions, look at our teachings. We realize that the whole point is to set ourselves free. It speaks in terms of freedom from current conditions, imprisonment, enslavement, employment even, whatnot. But really, the idea is to free us from the perception of ourselves through the other's eyes. That's what we need to be free from. Free yourself in consciousness and allow it to be attached to, as our founders would say, God's law of good, and God's law of good only. When the one thinker is God, and when we allow that one God mind to produce ideas in man, they come forth and produce in kind. And that's the freedom we are looking for. Free ourselves from attachment to what others think of us. Melinda Kramer and Fanny Brooks James write this in terms of learning to ride a bike, a rather simplistic example. When you're learning to ride a bike, if you're focused on what you're trying to avoid, you'll hit it. If you're focused on the ground, you'll fall over. However, if you look straight ahead to your goal, you'll usually reach it safely. The same law applies to our thinking. Look away from appearances of evil and keep our eye fixed upon the good we wish, and we shall reach that goal. If we focus our attention on what the other person thinks, we'll never get anywhere. For our perception, our feeling of what the other is thinking about is a vagary. It has no solid ground. And instead of producing and manifesting from our God-given talents, we instead enslave ourselves to the other. And when we do that, we are lost. When we can break free from that, we will have experienced a major metaphysical breakthrough, and we will understand the meaning of freedom. Of course, I don't mean to talk all about ourselves. There is a place for this in social reform, and it is huge, because we have a huge duty. Once we have freed our self-consciousness from perception and attuned it to that of God, for how could any child of God, how could any individual expressing God's will look to either be an oppressor or look to do nothing for the oppressed? How could a true child of God stand by and watch another human being or worker be exploited? How could a child of God stand by and view the evils of slavery, the evils of a system that creates an oppressed class, and reward a system and continue to participate in that system, enable it, if you will, that allows for such an oppression, even rewards such an oppression? I was extremely disturbed to read an article in yesterday's Washington Post that told of how presidential candidates, potential leaders of our country, have still not grasped this message. Have we learned nothing in the 250 years of our history? Forgetting politics and our national allegiance at the moment, have we ourselves learned nothing as a human race that we would continue on the way that we have been and expect to bear no consequences? Martin Luther King Jr. brought liberation theology to the civil rights movement. And here is an excerpt from his letter in the Birmingham jail, which I submit lays out the path for all of us in our godlike consciousness. He writes, but more basically, I am in Birmingham because injustice is here. Just as the prophets of the 8th century BC left their villages and carried their thus saith the Lord far beyond the boundaries of their hometowns, and just as the apostle Paul left his village of Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus Christ to the far corners of the Greco-Roman world, so am I compelled to carry the gospel of freedom beyond my own home. Like Paul, I must constantly respond to the Macedonian call for aid. Moreover, King writes, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Never again can we afford to live with the narrow, provincial, outside agitator idea. Anyone who lives inside the United States can never be considered an outsider anywhere within its bounds. We are not outsiders if we will free our self-consciousness from the state of relying on it to be revealed through the perception of another. Once that is free, and once we have freed our consciousness to become God's perfect child, we are no longer an outsider. We are no longer an agitator. We are the standard bearer for a new way of thinking, moving, and being. A standard bearer for a society built on love and collaboration and not on war and oppression. And there is a risk to this. Those who speak truth to empire are, of course, assassinated, crucified, and at the very least condemned, more likely than not in this day and age, ignored. Theologian James H. Cone comments on this. The cross is the symbol of crucifixion by empire, and how it treats those who speak up against it in the name of God, truth, and decency. Cone queries why we in modern times see the cross as an ornamental adornment rather than what it truly is, a symbol for how we can be tormented by empire for speaking the truth and yet feel the love of God in all its fullness and glory. For we are all broken humanly, and that is joyful, as we can then be open to receiving God's love like the prodigal son coming to himself in the husks and among the swine, merely taking that first step, and God is there to meet us more than halfway and rejoice in our mutual recognition for who and what we truly are. You see, God is always on the side of the oppressed, the dispossessed, the sinner. He's always on the side of the prodigal son. And so if we are oppressed for speaking the truth to oppression, so what? We are going to find that we will be in good company. After all, wouldn't you rather hang out with Jesus if you could? We are grateful and thankful for metaphysics, divine science, liberation theology. For all those disciplines, we are taking a large step towards releasing ourselves from the imprisonment of old, worn-out thinking. We know we need to align our true nature and be able to speak truth to empire the exact way that Jesus spoke to Pilate 2,000 years ago. We need to know that we should be like the prophet Micah and speak truth to the king, whether the king wants to hear it or not. After all, the king is nothing but a symbol of our own mental thought process, perhaps gone awry. What good is a kingdom, a life, if you will, built on sand? What good is a kingdom, a life that eats itself alive, cannibalizes itself? It's up to us in our daily prayer work. It's up to us in our individual thought. It is up to us in our actions to carry out the principles of divine science, to carry out into action the principles of metaphysics, to carry out the principles, if you will, of liberation theology, and stand in our truth. For it is our truth that works. In truth, we shall come to know the truth. In truth, we shall realize that the truth shall set us free. We should take a few moments now to have a short meditation and take into contemplation some of the concepts that we considered this morning. So let's close our eyes, sit up straight. Take in a couple of cleansing breaths and let them out slowly. Center ourselves and just relax. Who is it who darkens my thoughts? Were you with God at the beginning of time? Who directs my thoughts away from my own sense of self? Who dares to force me to follow? Who dares me to follow material effect, power, and worldly goods? Who dares me to see the world from its eyes? There is no regaining material wealth. It is not who we are. There is no regaining power. It is not of us. There is no tricking the people into thinking we are something we are not. We need not bother with all this foolishness. for the things of man are foolishness with God. God is all there is. Let us keep our thinking on God. With God, you shall know the truth about yourself. The truth about yourself shall set you free. Amen. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May he cause his light to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. Turn within and acknowledge him so that he may give you his peace. Amen. Free your self-consciousness and sense of self from any worldly perceptions. And remember, you are God's child, and you are to carry out his will. Align your thinking to God, and all will be well. Have a blessed week.